Let's go ahead. And the subject now is the Babylonish captivity. After the papacy of Innocent III, Pope Innocent III, 1216, the papacy itself continued to develop along the lines that had been drawn up by Hildebrand, continued on into the 1300s to develop along those same lines. Popes triumphed over the Hohenstaufen family. Great men occupied the papal chair, but there were hidden forces of evil that were at work behind the scenes, beneath the surface. A kind of evil leaven. And you know, leaven is sometimes described as that which is healthy and good and right, but also at other times that which is evil. I want to list some of these weaknesses. For one thing, Rome was like a tall building that had been getting taller and taller and taller and outgrowing her foundation. Bernard, who was a close friend of Pope Eugenicus III, wrote the Pope a confidential letter, a very severe warning. It's sort of the old prof who's writing to one of his students, who's now out from under him in a very dangerous position. Bernard called it on self-consideration. That was the text of his letter, on self-consideration. Terribly plain, warning against moral secularization. In effect, what Bernard said was that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Pope. And that was never more true than with the Pope. Second danger, nations were beginning to waken up to develop a political self-consciousness, an awareness of the political identity capable of an independent political life of their own, and that this could be part of God's plan for them to thus have a separate political national loyalty and purpose, apart from their loyalty to the Pope and the Church. And the more Rome tried to stamp that idea out and build a number one loyalty to herself and herself alone, the more she and they became focused on the issue. The more the people reacted to the Pope and to the Church. For example, when Rome tried to stamp out the Gothic liturgy in Spain, it backfired, and people demanded their political freedom all the more. The same thing happened in the Slavonic parts of the Eastern Europe. Rome did not seem to understand that there can be more strength in diversity than there is in uniformity. Each member of the body, she thought, must be absolutely the same. But in France, Philip won his battle with Pope Boniface VIII. And in England, Edward III, the King of Parliament, won their battles with the Pope too. Now, an important part of this awakening in this of national political life had to do with the national languages. People were beginning to recognize and to insist that the truth of God's word and worship could be accomplished through their own languages. It could be that their own languages could be used to communicate instead of just Latin. That these things could be communicated through French and German and English, and not just being forced to go through the Latin language of Rome. Dante wrote in English, and Dante's Divine Comedy is a kind of a swan song for a dying and departing Middle Ages. The dying out and departing of Latin was one strong indication that a lot of other things were beginning to die and to leave too. There were moral supports for the papacy that were falling away. People were getting tired of the Crusades. They always lost. There didn't seem to be anything that was gained or really changed. The Pope could not go on sending an obstreperous prince or to Palestine, hoping that he would never come back, and then do whatever he wanted with the lands and the peoples of that prince while the prince was gone. That's another side to the Crusades that we don't often hear about. As the Pope could get these leaders of the various jurisdictions, the various countries, and the various communities to go away, then he could have his way with the people who were left behind. After Frederick II broke his Crusader's vow and got away with it, so did many others. People no longer gave money for Crusades. They didn't go through the Pope's hands. And the Pope no longer had veteran soldiers home from the Crusades who were willing to obey his voice and go wherever he sent them to enforce his will in the other parts of the world. A fifth factor here was that Boniface VIII in 1294 to 1303 was the first man to show how far the papacy had gone beyond its foundations. It had reached the peak, and now it was beginning to recede. He was the right man to start that decline and fall. He was proud, talking about Boniface VIII. He was ambitious. He claimed things that Gregory VII and Innocent III wouldn't ever have dreamed about. In spite of the fact that in their times, they might have gotten away with it, this man, Boniface VIII, was not able to get away with. Boniface VIII claimed for himself the right to disinherit kings. We're talking about church-state relationships here. Boniface VIII claimed the right to disinherit kings. He took to himself as pope the words of Jeremiah 1:10. And I guess, did we get those written? See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. That's the spirit, the attitude in that pope. And of Paul in 1 Corinthians 2:15. But he that is spiritual judgeth all things, yet he himself is judged of no man. And so in effect you can see him setting himself. Now watch this. Watch this. This is important today in terms of the position of the Pope today. And then going on in the words of Peter in Luke 21 and 32, but I have prayed for thee, Peter, that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. And going on then to Boniface claimed that these were the two, that there were two swords, the sword of the church and the sword of the state, and that this scripture authorized him as pope to wield both those swords, Luke 22:38. They said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. He said unto them, it is enough. It's very important for you to know that the pope in history has claimed to hold both those swords, not just the sword of the church, but also the sword of the state. And in Genesis 1:16, the creation and the lesser lights and the greater lights. The greater lights, this pope interpreted as being the priesthood, and the lesser lights, the magistracy or the political world. Now I say this pope has done that. No pope ever since then has ever undone that or denied that or tried to change that. Gregory VII and Innocent III had kept appealing to all these scriptures, and it worked. But now after under Boniface, it did not. He insisted that it was the truth. But the people wouldn't receive it because the times had changed. And so Boniface told himself, found that he himself was matched now with a man who was just as crafty and as ambitious as he was, and that man is Philip the Fair in France, 1285 to 1314. He took up where the Hohenstaufen had left off. He began with peace, but he very quickly went to war. War of words with the Pope himself. And there were no decent words. Finally, the Pope excommunicated Philip. The papal bull of November 18, 1302, the Unum Sanctum, stated this: "We declare, define, and pronounce that subjection to the Roman pontiff is for every human being altogether of necessity for salvation." Now, that Unum Sanctum has never been rescinded. You need to look at that and to read that in terms of current events. One of the most horrible blunders that President Reagan ever made was to send a delegate, what do you call him, an ambassador to the court of the Pope in Rome, submitting, I'm sure he didn't know it, to this idea. It's not an idea, it's a declaration. We define, declare, and pronounce that subjection to the Roman pontiff is for every human being altogether of necessity for salvation. You can't be saved aside from subjection to the Pope. And Philip, by all this, was unfazed. He simply sidestepped the personal issues and made it a national quarrel and appealed it to a future council and a true Pope. If the battle had continued, the king probably would have won, but it ended when Boniface was surprised in his country palace in September 7 of 1303 by a band of outlaws headed by a man who just happened to be a friend of Philip, and the Pope was tortured and then finally died. Yes?
How big was that in place to a document like ECT be endorsed by?
They don't know it. They don't know these facts. They haven't read this history. And this is what John Gerstner was trying to tell him. And they were laughing all the way to the printing press, those members who did know about it. And there was more than one Roman Catholic man who was deeply involved in that.
Do you really think that the Catholic Church has set that aside?
They have not. They've not set that aside. I'm not sure that they could set it aside, because of other actions taken since then.
Well, the papal infallibility is still there.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is a papal statement ex cathedra. They can't change that. That's the point? Yeah. When he speaks ex cathedra, it cannot be changed. And when you find Protestants getting together and signing on with this, And I'm sure that there are many, many, many well-meaning Roman Catholic men, and Dr. Gerstner's told me many times of his debating with the professors and the teachers in their leading educational institutions across the nation. And he had to spend just as much time teaching them what their church believed as he did then proving that that was not right, because they don't know it. The man in the pew doesn't know it unless he happens to be a medieval scholar, and the priest doesn't know it, and many of the bishops don't know it. I can't help but think that the cardinals must know it. And who was the solidly Roman Catholic man who was on that Catholics and Protestants. I can't think his name right now. I'm confident, though, that he knew that. Newhouse. Yeah. I'm confident that he knows about this. And Boniface was surprised and captured and tortured, and he finally died at the hands of a man who was a friend of Philip. Now, out of this came the first great humiliation to the papacy, the transfer of the papal seat from Rome to Avignon. And then three great Western councils that we're going to talk about in more detail later on. And then the Reformation. This was the beginning. This is why I say this was the beginning of the downfall. Yes?
Was Boniface not popular, and that's why he was tortured and killed? This was a group that knew exactly what they were doing?
No, it was... he knew what he was doing, all right, and he was too popular with many people. But Philip saw that this was the only way of tackling the whole problem. He had to strike at the root, and so he went directly. He didn't do it himself.
He had
a gang. I'm sure we're seeing some of the same things at the top levels in the United States today.
Did he make any sort of a public statement after the death?
No, not that I know of. He was remarkably silent. Tom?
You say he results all of this. All of this being what? The death of the Pope?
This beginning of the downfall of the papacy, this change to Avignon.
Was the result of all this? Results of what?
The results of going back to the positive, the papal bull, the Unum Sanctum.
Okay, here's the results of the Unum Sanctum.
Yeah. And of Boniface's being surprised in his country palace and captured and killed. Yes, but the king was, Philip was a very wise, wily man. And he just out-poped the Pope when it came to that kind of thing. What the Pope had been doing to others, he did to the Pope.
And he had enough charisma and popularity with people also that he...
Yeah, that was it. That was it. And he was able to carry it. He just, as I said before, he sidestepped the personal issues. The Pope had excommunicated him, you're going to burn in hell for eternity. He said, fine, let's make it a national issue. And it led to the Reformation. Boniface began the decline. The early death of the... Dante put Boniface in the dangerous city, but not in hell, in his writings. And when you get back into Dante, read some of Dante. You get a tremendous amount of history there. He was a very discerning man. Benedict the 11th succeeded Boniface and died a few months later, assisted by Philip. Dr. Kevorkian... is not new. Now Philip contrived to have Clement V become the Pope. He was a man who was totally obedient to Philip. They moved the papacy first to Bordeaux and then again to Avignon, not actually in France, but surrounded by France. And there from 1309 to 1377, the popes, he and six others, sat in what's called the Babylonian captivity. many reasons why this kind of thing jeopardized the papacy. They were torn away from the imperial city. All the status and history of ancient historical or political Rome. They were no longer an objectivity. The Pope could not be an umpire in the political world. The papacy belonged to France. So she couldn't really approach these other nations with an objectivity. No longer could claim a universal monarchy. Couldn't do anything really without the permission of the French king. Actually became part of King Philip's persecution of the Knights Templar. If you want a very exciting history sometime, go into do some research on the subject of the Knights Templar coming out of the Crusades and then other things. But instead of supporting the Pope as originally intended to do, under Philip's control, the Pope actually became part of the persecution of the Knights Templar. It was an unlovely time. Physically, it was an ugly fortress prison on the banks of the Rhone River. The morals of the Pope's court were absolutely horrible. Petrarch, a deputy from Rome, went to plead with the Pope and the king to bring the Pope back to Rome. And he describes the morals, the immoralities that were rampant. Petrarch's letters, written in 1342. Let me ask that if you do go and pick that up and begin reading on it, make sure you know why you're reading it. Because Satan can use that kind of thing to describe profligacy in such a way that does your mind feed on that, or does it have to read that? Petrarch didn't write it in order to get other people to become immoral. Petrarch wrote it as a man who went back there to reform it. And he's describing what it is that he's trying to do. And he was not successful. Several such deputations, finally, in 1377, Gregory the 11th was able to be brought back. They were able to bring him back to Rome in 1377. People were more and more critical of the papacy because of all this. A physician in Padua, Italy, wrote the most severe of all criticisms, the Defense Pacis, Defensio Pacis, in 1328 by Dr. Massilio. Erastian, in the church-state controversy, but Presbyterian, insofar as church government was concerned. Marsilio, the Defensio Pacis, written in 1328. You begin to see the beginnings of a Presbyterian form of government in what he's writing in order to try to clean up what was a very desperate moral situation. And then William of Ockham also spoke out against the papacy. He was a nominalist who spoke up for the people, individual man and his rights versus the Pope and his position. That's Luther's friend, my dear Ockham, he said. And Rome no longer had any answers. There was a time when she was not only silenced, a man like Abelard, she contradicted him. And so she proved her point. Rome now can no longer do such things. Times are ripening for a reformation. That's just a little bit of an overview of the Babylonish captivity. And I admit that there are things that I'm not telling you here. I don't think they're necessary. Maybe I'm wrong. But the depths of degradation to which the church went then is just unbelievable. I want to go on now to the great Western councils. We have traced the end of the Babylonish captivity But there was worse yet to come. An evil that was growing out of the captivity. A thing that took away something yet more of the glory of the papacy. And that was the great schism of the West. That picked up where the captivity ended. And is it easy to see the connection between these two things? During the captivity, Babylonian captivity, a party had been developed in the Sacred College of Cardinals there in Rome, whose responsibility it was to elect the Pope. That was it became 100% devoted to the French king, Philip. Remember I told you, he was a very wise man. He knew how to maneuver politically. And so he simply came to pack the College of Cardinals. And at one point, it was 100% submissive to whatever Philip wanted. He had put them into their position. They were very, very eager to keep the Pope under the control of the King of France, even though he's now living back in Rome. The other party in the College of Cardinals was 100% Italian. One party, 100% French, the other one, 100% Italian. It was much smaller now than the French party. They wanted to see the Pope out from under the control of the French king. And when Pope Gregory the 11th died in 1378, the real battle began between France and Italy for the ownership of the papacy and all the benefices that it carried with it. France trying to retain and Italy trying to regain. But the French cardinals did not resist the election of an Italian pope, although they far outnumbered the Italians. So Urban VI, who was Italian, was elected. And it would have been hard to find a man better suited to build a little breach, into a big break. He was a harsh, violent, cruel man. Before long, the French cardinals actually moved out of Rome, couldn't stand it, complaining that their very lives were at stake. The Roman people had been roused against them, so they couldn't get a vote in of their own choice. After they withdrew, they simply elected another pope of their own, Clement VII, 1378. Clement set up office again back in Avignon. So now we have two popes. A very embarrassing situation for those who insist on... what's the name of that? My mind slips me. You have to be able to trace your own ordination all the way back to Peter. Apostolic succession. A very embarrassing situation. Because how do you trace it all the way back when there are two men who are claiming to be Pope back there? And that was the beginning of the Great Schism, which continued on for 38 years, from 1378 to 1416. Notice we're getting very close to the years of the Reformation. This had a profound effect on the papacy. The papacy would never again be what it once had been. The great moral strength of the papacy had lain in the unity that it seemed to bring to the whole church, the papa of the entire church. The Pope was both the symbol of that unity and the guarantee of the unity of the church as a whole. But now when there were two, how could there be only one church? True, there had been some anti-popes before this. Alexander III had outlived three anti-popes in his 22 years of reign. In 1033, there had been three popes for a while. But this was the biggest schism and the one that really separated in such a way that people began to think that maybe there could be two churches. But these had all been proven to be false, these others, when there were two and when there were three. And they had died. This was not true now. Both popes held their crown now. And the very title and position which held the whole church together was now the source of a horrible division. For half a century, everyone was forced into one of the two churches, one of the two camps. And it was serious. Because, you see, they believed that their very salvation depended on their being in communion with the Pope, who was the true successor of Peter. Yes?
How does the Catholic Church present this experience?
They're very embarrassed by it. And,
they follow a certain line and discount the other?
Yeah. Yeah. And you'll see them, and they've traced it out and decided which was right and which was wrong.
Which could they usually claim now?
The one that's at Rome. And you can get these lists from them. You can see that. And then they will, every time that comes out, it's a reinforcement. This is the right one. It is the only one. Because the subsequent Pope has declared it to be the only one. And of course, he cannot make any mistake. But the point I'm making here now is that their very salvation depended, it was a serious, serious thing going on, because their salvation depended upon their being under the jurisdiction of the right Pope. If they were under the wrong Pope, they would suffer in hell for eternity. And that's how serious it was for them. The wrong or false Pope must be it would lead you to hell, yes.
Did the guy in the street know that?
Yes. When the Pope announced an interdict over an entire community because a given king or prince or lord or someone like that was getting out of line, and this happened all through the years, then the priests in that area would be very quick to tell the people that they better get their prince back in line.
So did the two of them interdict each other?
Well, a prince, and this happened with the king on several occasions, the king who forswore his crusader vows. Every place that man went was under interdict from the Pope. Anyone who died while it was under interdict would automatically go to hell.
Okay, but the two anti-popes, did they interdict each other?
Oh, yes. They didn't hesitate to curse each other. Just the same way that the Roman Church cursed the Greek Orthodox Church, so these popes, not all of them with the same ferociousness. But yes, they did that. Yet no one could know for sure who was the false and who was the true. Whether he lived with the Pope in Rome, lined up with the Pope in Rome, were all the people in England, in Germany, in Italy, in Denmark, in Sweden, in Poland, and Prussia. On the side of the Pope in Avignon were France and Scotland and Spain and Portugal and Lorraine. And the dual papacy also brought a lot of other burden, double taxation. It had been hard enough to keep the Pope's court supplied with money when only one of them, that was the one in Rome, but now there were two of them. There were two courts, two colleges of cardinals. And so the church began to sell off almost anything that she had on earth or in heaven. Men were made miserable because of all this. And I didn't make a mistake when I said that the church was beginning to sell off valuable properties that she said that she had in heaven. We'll talk about that later. Neither side would listen to appeals, asking one of the two to resign. Many good men pointed out that the good shepherd gave not only his office, but his life for his sheep. The papacy was dragged through the mud of controversy, and finally, in order to avoid the disgrace of becoming a thing of ridicule in the eyes of all the princes of the world, the two colleges of cardinals got together and called for a council. That was the only way out. The church in general would declare herself under Christ to be greater than any pope, able to act without the pope, to judge between two popes, to remove one of the two, to judge any pope for sin, and remove him and elect another, and to do anything else that needed to be done to remove the scandal and reform the church. Now with the council, we're just beginning to catch a glimmer of the whole subject of reformation. This was the work of the Paris doctores, the doctors in Paris. John Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N, 1365 to 1429, Chancellor of the University of Paris. Cardinal D'Ailly, it's a little D and then A-I-L-L-Y, Cardinal D'Ailly, 1350 to 1425, also Chancellor of the University of Paris. For many years, these men had been teaching and writing about the absolute necessity of an authority that could hold popes accountable. Now the time had come, and circumstances were right. The three great Western councils that we're coming to talk about now were a remarkable close to the pre-Reformation period, and a very important factor in preparing the world for the Reformation itself. These councils were stately and majestic in appearance, very important in fact, large in promise and small in performance. And yet, while seeming to have done so little or nothing at all, they nevertheless had a vast and penetrating influence on the future church history. They prepared the way and opened the minds of people for the whole subject of Reformation on a bigger scale than they themselves were ever able to accomplish. The first council was the Council of Pisa. Now, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is it, Pisa. March 25 through August 7 of 1409. Not very long. There were just two items on their agenda, two things that they wanted to accomplish, but they were very, very closely tied to each other. The first, the restoration of the peace in the church through the restoration of the unity of the church. The restoration of the peace through the restoration of the unity of the church. And second, the reformation of the church in its head and its members. And that's a very important little phrase, the reformation in its head and in its members. That was the phrase that everyone was using. Those were the buzzwords to describe what needed to be done in its head and in its members. Both needed to be reformed. The Council of Pisa was an impressive-looking council made up of 23 cardinals, 200 bishops, either in person or by proxy, 300 abbots, 500 doctors of theology, doctors of canon law, doctors of civil law, representatives of civil government. The Parisian doctores were the guiding lights. Since the council had called itself together, not waiting for a pope to authorize it, it had declared itself to have a higher authority than the popes had. And the first thing the council did was to proclaim in writing, in the most authoritative and official way, its own authority. A very wise move. Next, the two rival popes, Gregory the 12th and Benedict the 13th, were summoned to appear, either by proxy or by person. Neither pope even answered the summons, because both had already repudiated the very authority of the council. Their trial proceeded anyway, and both were condemned as being schismatic heretics, perjurers. They were removed by official action from St. Peter's chair, and it was declared to be vacant. Then the council made a colossal blunder. They immediately elected another pope, Alexander V. Instead of moving ahead with the work of reformation of the head and of the body, they just elected another head. And instantly, all the parties began to work together with jealousy and hostility towards each other in the same way they had worked around the other popes. Alexander was an old man, 70 years old, of a very weak character. And the people soon persuaded him that the most important thing he could do was to get rid of the council that had elected him. And so he announced a vague intention to clean up some of the glaring wrongs that had been the reason for the calling of the council. He pleaded the fact that many had already left the council to return home, and he adjourned it for 3 years. The council lasted for just about 4 months. In some ways, the Council of Pisa left matters worse than they had been before, with three popes instead of two. For the other two popes did not step down just because they had been summarily dismissed by the council. The men called it now a cerebrus, a three-headed monster. And then when Alexander V died just a year later, and incidentally, you see so many of these popes are only in their few years. They were old men when they went in. And they didn't know anything about the bureaucracy of Rome. They were easily controlled and just caught up in it. You heard President Eisenhower and a number of others say how hard it was for him to do anything. The State Department had been in business for so long that he just sort of had to fit in with their procedures. Well, that was true of the popes in Rome. And you see an old man elected. He's past his prime. He's not gone beyond the point where he'd stand up and really argue with someone and insist on what was right or wrong or something like that. He just fits in with what's already going on. Later in 1410, the College of Cardinals did an amazing thing. Some say they were bribed. Some say they were terrified. Maybe it was both. But they elected the worst possible man, a very, very, very able man, but a very, very, very wicked man. Baltasar Cossa was the way he was called. You know, Baltasar Cossa. Pope John the 23rd. And every time I hear Pope John, I can't help remembering a little bit of history. Men called him the incarnate devil. He hated the very idea of calling another council, but he was eventually driven to call another council. He had stirred up so many enemies that he had to go to the emperor-elect, Sigismund, for physical protection. And the emperor promised to protect him on one condition, and that is that he would fulfill the pledge of his predecessor, already long overdue, to call another council. And the issue was also forced that this next council must be held outside of Italy, because there were so many bishops in Italy that the others were always outnumbered. So the Council of Constance was the next of these three councils. 1414 to 1418. Notes that 4 years it lasted. It outdazzled the Council of Pisa, and it exceeded all those that came after it. Their agenda had just three items on it. First, to bring the schism to an end, the scandal of Pope John to be terminated. Second, to pass a judgment on the teachings of Wycliffe and Huss. So now we're really driving into the Reformation times. And third item on their agenda, to carry out the reform in head and in members. That item, the same as it was for the first one. The first item was accused of so many crimes and so horrible, horrible moral and immoral life. Pope John resigns rather than face investigation. Sound a little similar sometimes, doesn't it? The second item, doctrines of Wycliffe were condemned. Huss and Jerome of Prague were burned. The bones of Wycliffe were also dug up and burned. The third item, the council made the same blunder again. Instead of going ahead to exact reform, they just elected another pope. And to many people, a church without a pope couldn't be a church. It was like a hive without a queen bee. And even the Parisian doctors acted unwisely here. Instead of going ahead with the reform and then electing a pope, they just elected one, and they were right back where they had begun. This time they elected Martin V, a man of excellent character, that is, compared to his predecessors. I don't know whether to tell you this story or not, but Jim Dobson told a story. Jim Dobson, so it must be all right to tell. About how this church was in a building program, and the man in the city who was the notorious, I mean, he was a mafia, mafia de mafia. He was involved in everything that was wrong. And he went to the pastor and he said, if you will bury my brother, conduct his funeral service, and say in process that he's an angel, then you'll have all the money you need for building this whole church and everything else for the rest of the life of this church. He says, I can't do that because you know him. And he says, he's been in drugs, he's been in the gangs, he's been in prostitution, he's been in everything that's wrong. He says, well, that's your offer. If you can bury him and say that he's an angel, then you'll have that. So, on the day of the funeral, the pastor agreed to do it, and on the day of the funeral, he simply stood up. And he said, now you citizens of this community know this man, and you know that he was involved in drugs, he was involved in prostitution, he was involved in gambling, he was involved in all of that. But compared to his brother here, he was a real angel. May have been a little bit that way with Martin V. Compared to the ones who came before him and some of the ones who came after him, he was a man of excellent character. But the glory of the council faded away in the presence of the glory of the Pope. And even before the council is adjourned, he indicates that he will not be reformed and even approves of some of the old abuses. Martin V was a political man. He made separate concordats with some of the other countries to divide and to conquer. Martin made many promises, and when he left the city of Constance on May 16 of 1418, the bridle of his horse was held by on one side by the emperor, and on the other side by the elector of Brandenburg. And they say that 45,000 people were in his procession. He probably thought that the papacy was back to its old position, and that the scars of the Babylonish captivity and the great schism and all the other little schisms were all covered over and healed with the old unity. But the future would never again be what it once had been. Men now knew that power corrupts a pope, just as absolutely as it corrupts anyone else. And I hurry on to the last of these three great councils. The council had done so little to the papacy that the popes no longer feared another council. But the Pope himself had three reasons for wanting this third council. The first one was that Bohemia was burning with war against the Hussites, and other nations were also beginning to burn. And second, there was still the possibility of some healing of the relationship between the Latin church in the West and the Greek church in the East. And the third point on the item on the agenda was that there was still need to appease in the church those who were demanding that there be a reform in the head and in the members. And so, in connection with a rule laid down in the Council of Constance, Pope Eugenicus IV called a third council together. It's called the Council of Basel, B-A-S-L-E, 1431 to 1449, Switzerland, of course. But now, so many who had wanted reform before and had seen so little of it didn't even respond to the summons. They didn't even come to the meeting. The Council of Basel almost died in the cradle before it had even begun. Very few attended. But from the very beginning, it showed a spirit of rebellion or revolution against the Pope who had called it. It was willing to work hard. It began to dialogue with the Hussites until the Pope stopped that. He tried to dissolve the council, but they wouldn't be dissolved. They retorted by declaring no Pope could dissolve them or change their place of meeting. They summoned Pope Eugenicus and his cardinals, and they began the work of reformation. At first, Eugenicus went along with them. He stopped the papal bull that would have anathematized the entire council, that is, excommunicating every one of them. He stopped that. But before long, Pope and council were battling head-to-head. The Pope demanding more money, for one thing. And on September 18, 1437, the Pope ordered the council to move to Ferrara in Italy on the pretext that it would be better for healing the breach between the Greek church and the Italian church. But the council saw it as a pretext and they refused to budge. And then they suspended the Pope. And then finally that council deposed the Pope on July 7, 1439, and they elected Felix V, a man who had been Duke of Savoy, had been living as a hermit on the banks of Lake Geneva. But the people did not approve of that action. The council lost favor. Felix died in 1448, and this council failed just as ignominiously as the other two before it. I want to talk a little bit about the councils now, just in a general sort of way. Could the councils have succeeded in their desire to reform the heart and the head? I don't think so. Because the leaders did not see that the real issue was that they did not understand the sickness that made the church sick. They kept thinking that the right pope, or the pope that was right, was an absolute necessity for the church to be a church. No pope, no church. If we don't have a pope, we can't be a church. That was the fallacy in their thinking. But what was really needed was to come to the knowledge that no pope was needed at all. What they needed was to get rid of the very idea of a man who had in himself all of the offices of Christ, and to get rid of the very idea that a man could ever unify the church, that he was God's representative, God's particular, only representative on earth. They failed to see that this was really arrogating to a person, a responsibility and a position that had been given to Christ and Christ alone. Instead of that, remember again that the risen, ascended Lord, not any man, Pope man, would ever bring all the unity and purity that the church ever needed. They failed to see that. They put a man into the position that only Christ has been given. They would admit no errors of doctrine in the church, only abuses in practice. They refused to see that the abuses were rooted in doctrine, and that the bad doctrine continued to feed poison into the practices. Instead of seeing these issues and dealing with them, they dug up the bones of the man who pointed out the fatal errors and burned them. Talking about Wycliffe. But in spite of their wrongnesses, the Lord, who had said, "I will build my church," so overruled them that the councils became a factor in bringing about a far truer reformation than they had ever dreamed about. The idea that Hildebrand had of a church society in which only one person had any rights at all, the Pope, had never been debated and decided, albeit by default, and it simply could not be true that every pope had failed. They just couldn't admit that. The papacy was a tree that was deeply rooted, and it would take many, many blows of an axe to bring it down. But the councils were one of those blows. They were headed in the right direction. Why were the councils so important and yet so ineffective? Well, distance was one of them. Travel time was one reason. That's one reason why they met and selected a pope and did what no person intended. The council had nothing to give away, and the pope had so much to give away. The canons and the deaneries and the bishoprics and the cardinalates. The councils were poor, and the pope was rich, the papacy. The councils were defeated, but they left behind them embarrassments, questions that the Roman Catholic Church still has to wrestle with. Were their decisions and pronouncements legal and authoritative, and therefore part of church tradition and law? See, the Church of Rome still has to wrestle with that question. And the Church of Rome has not come out and reviewed these, and will not, because that position has been put to her again and again. To admit them is to admit to a higher prior authority to the Pope. To admit the councils is to admit that there's a higher authority than the Pope. And all his papal infallibility and his papal authority. To refuse to admit them, on the other hand, is to refuse to admit the foundations on which the Pope's election actually rests. The Roman Catholic Church has decided that question by saying that whatever the councils do, which is right, shall stand as final doctrine. But whatever the councils declares or decides that is not right shall not stand. And the Pope makes the final decision about what is right and what is not right. In 1517, Pope Pius II effectively erased the record clear of all the actions of the three great Western councils, that they might in any way jeopardize the absolute authority of the Pope. We're right back into the doctrine and the position of the Roman Catholic Church today. And I pray that every one of you will remember that and think about it carefully when you hear that over and over and over again, Charles Colson especially. Charles Colson's wife is a Roman Catholic, and it is widely reported that he is headed back, or he is headed into the Roman Catholic Church. But the cry that comes out, but the church has changed. The church has changed. The church is not the same. It's changed. But you do not find any place, and I've thrown this out again and again, where these kinds of things were ever changed by the church. I'd like to do a little bit of review of Christian life and work in the Middle Ages, but I think maybe we'd better tie off tonight, because there's 30 minutes more of lecture, and it's only 10 minutes to 10 at this point. We've really broken the back out of the most of the information of the medieval church, and I'm sorry, I wish there was some way of tracing these up year by year by year so that you could see them, but that would take up so much detail that you wouldn't see the big pictures. And so in order to show you the big picture of the councils and of the papacy and of the revival of learning and so forth, I've had to take them up almost piecemeal and separate and throw them to you. And your timeline is going to be very, very important. So please keep that timeline out in front of you. And then at the beginning of every lecture, I will try to identify the time period when we're working. And do we have any more of those timelines left?
Yes, not here. There are nothing.
Not here. Let's see if we can get another one. And then you might be interested in writing that in. The timeline's not filled all in. As you can see from Michael's there, it's something that you keep writing in as you go along. And Tom here has a 8.5 by 11 timeline that just lists everything like this. And it's in his mind in the same way it is there. He doesn't need a picture to keep things straight. But not everybody's mind is like Tom Sullivan's. It's the mind of an engineer. Let's bow our heart in prayer. Father in heaven, I'd pray that you would bless us as we would see actions in the past which are having implications and influences today. God, we see you through all this, though, advancing your church, advancing still from strength to strength. They forward go. And we see you advancing your church. And we also see where believers back there then made time for you, and that there were believers then. God, I'd pray that you would bless us as we would not just lump all the bad with all the good, but that we would see where there was that which was true faith in the midst of all this corruption and immorality, and that you were building, in spite of all this, you have continued building your church. In Jesus' name we pray it. Amen. There have been so much of the horrible evil I want to read you for just a moment in closing here a statement from Baronius, who is a contemporary historian. It is a laudable custom with many of both sexes, and these not of the humbler classless only, but of magnates and nobles, to set apart at least 1 hour at some set time every day for the recalling and meditating of the highest benefit bestowed on the human race, the passion of Jesus Christ. In all classes, there are men and women who are setting aside 1 hour a day to meditate on the scriptures and on the person of Jesus Christ. Now, I could desire that was true for the United States today. Yes.
Date on that.
Baronius. I don't think I have his dates. I don't have that. But you can find his name. I'm guessing it's about 15th century. I'm guessing it's about it. And it would be easy for us to see all these horrible things and to come to conclusion that there wasn't anything good that was there. But there were some great and wonderful things going on beneath the surface. That's the invisible yeast from the inside that Jesus Christ is working in. We'll talk some more about that next time. In addition to all the hypocrisy.